you're not going to want to get behind on your snow shoveling this weekend. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck, and our snow outlook tops our news tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce finds out how Lieutenant Governor Angela McClain is settling into her new job. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with the co-owner of a Butte distillery about being named Montana Entrepreneur of the Year. Before our top story tonight, we have this breaking news. Missoula County Attorney Fred Van Valkenburg says attorneys in his office are not biased against sexual assault victims and prosecute those crimes at a rate above or similar to other jurisdictions. Van Valkenburg makes the assertions in a five-page statement released late this afternoon in response to an earlier letter from the Federal Department of Justice, harshly critical of how the Missoula County Attorney's Office handles sexual assault cases. Van Valkenburg says the DOJ letter is, quote, clearly retaliatory for a lawsuit he has filed claiming DOJ does not have jurisdiction over his office. He goes on to say he cannot respond to specific charging decisions questioned by DOJ because the information is confidential and Montana law prohibits its disclosure. Finally, Van Valkenburg says bias is a problem, but with juries, not with prosecutors.
And in other news from around the state, snow bands dropped several quick inches in parts of western Montana this morning, but that's peanuts compared to what the National Weather Service is predicting for later this weekend. Meteorologist Ryan Leach says yet another Arctic front will push into western Montana starting Sunday morning. If the weather models hold up, an area stretching from Polson down through Missoula and the southern edge of the Bitterroot Valley and east to Butte could get significant snow. Specifically, at least 6 to 10 inches in the valleys and well over a foot in the mountains. And that's not all.
We'll have high pressure over south central Canada, and then we'll also have a low pressure system coming into the eastern Oregon. And that's going to cause a lot of wind in the area. And we're going to have easterly winds coming 10 to 20 miles an hour, northeasterly winds, affecting most of northwest Montana. And we'll expect stronger east winds through Hellgate and Bad Rock Canyons, 20 to 30 miles per hour. And also with that 15 to 25 mile an hour winds coming out of the southwest, those are going to be bringing a lot of moisture in, overrunning that cold air, and that's what's going to set up the big snow event for us.
The expected snow could have major travel impacts by early Monday along the Highway 12 corridor and I-90 from Lookout Pass to the Homestake Pass. Areas north of Polson probably won't get as much snow. 4 to 6 inches are possible. The average temperature this time of year for west central Montana ranges from the mid-30s to mid-40s.
When this comes in on Monday, you know, we're looking at the temperatures dropping Sunday night into Monday, and cold temperatures on Monday with highs probably somewhere in the low 20s to teens range for most areas. Central Idaho is not going to get, it doesn't look like it's going to get as cold, especially once you get away from the mountain passes. When the real cold air starts to push in is Tuesday night, but, you know, again, we're expecting some east winds to persist then, so that'll keep things mixed up and a little bit warmer. Low temperatures down in the single digits and the teens are possible Tuesday morning.
The snow and cold could be particularly dangerous for newborn livestock and further aggravate already dangerous avalanche conditions. More on weather later on in this broadcast.
Montana's Attorney General is asking the U.S. Justice Department to send him the evidence in sexual assault cases the agency believes the Missoula County Attorney's Office should have prosecuted but didn't. The Missoulian Report's Attorney General Tim Fox made the request in a letter to Montana U.S. Attorney Michael Cotter yesterday. A Justice Department report released last Friday said investigators found rape cases the county attorney's office declined to prosecute despite having confessions and other evidence. Fox notes the DOJ told the Attorney General's office in June of 2012 that it would turn over any new evidence to the state. He says he assumes he didn't receive any information because there isn't any new evidence. Missoula County Attorney Fred Van Valkenburg has rejected the allegations in the DOJ report.
A Missoula man has been sentenced to 10 years in prison for driving drunk and hitting two sisters as they walked on the sidewalk, killing one. KECI-TV reports District Judge Ed McLean sentenced Tom George Vineyard today to 30 years in prison with 20 suspended for vehicular homicide under the influence and negligent vehicular assault. Vineyard pleaded guilty in October to the May 16th death of 39-year-old Roberta Demert and for injuries suffered by her sister, 41-year-old Pamela Demert. Prosecutors say Vineyard's blood alcohol level was 0.239, or nearly three times the legal limit, when he struck the women. Paula Demmert told law enforcement she and her sister were on their way to get cigarettes when they were hit. Paula Demmert suffered a broken leg.
Former Senator Max Baucus has been sworn in as the new U.S. ambassador to China. Vice President Joe Biden presided over a private ceremonial swearing-in today at the State Department. Baucus has also been officially sworn in by Secretary of State John Kerry. Baucus is a Montana Democrat and former chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. The Senate confirmed his nomination earlier this month. Baucus has said he wants to help build a better economic relationship with China. The U.S. trade deficit with China is far bigger than it is with any other country, and China is the largest foreign holder of U.S. debt. The State Department says outgoing Ambassador Gary Locke will remain in his role until Baucus departs the U.S. for China. That date hasn't been announced.
Montana's new Lieutenant Governor Angela McClain has been on the job nearly 2 weeks now. The former Anaconda High School teacher and chair of the Montana Board of Regents replaces Lieutenant Governor John Walsh, who is now serving the remainder of Max Baucus's U.S. Senate term. As we just reported, Baucus is now the U.S. ambassador to China. Lieutenant Governor McClain has already been around the state in her new role. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has the story.
Lieutenant Governor Angela McClain looks out the windows of her new office in the Capitol building. Sun is shining on Helena's new fallen snow. McClain commutes home to Anaconda on the weekends, though, and she's thinking about the forecast.
Watching the roads closely today and every day.
She's been spending a lot of time on those roads already while on the clock, traveling in her new role.
We've gone to Billings, we've gone to Missoula, to Great Falls twice.
So much so, in fact, she says today is her first real day in her actual office.
I've tried to check off my to-do list while I'm here because I know that these days will be few and far between.
The walls are essentially bare. She gets to pick out some artwork from the Montana Historical Society. She's had time to put up a few decorations, a picture of her family, a plant. On the shelves behind her desk, a University of Montana Grizzlies football helmet. She's a UM alum herself, but she's diplomatic, too.
I think there's a nice place for a cat helmet right over there, right next to some of those books, so that it's directly across from the Grizz helmet.
Governor Bullock says he chose McClain for the role in part because of her extensive experience with the state's educational system, both as a teacher and as a member of both the state's Board of Public Education and Board of Regents, which oversees the university system. McClain says education matters to every facet of what the Bullock administration wants to do in the state of Montana.
We cannot see economic development. We will not see job growth unless we have a strong, world-class, quality public education system.
She's the first public school teacher to serve as lieutenant governor and only the second female to sit in the role. She says she will be working with the governor's Equal Pay for Equal Work Task Force.
To make sure that now and down the road, we do all that we can to close those income gaps that exist between men and women.
She says she looks forward to promoting the agenda of the Bullock administration, but she does not intend to just be a figurehead. In the meantime, she's getting used to the idea of her office not also being a classroom. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
The National Transportation Safety Board has decided to conduct a full investigation of a United Airlines flight from Denver to Billings that hit turbulence over Wyoming, injuring five people. NTSB Public Affairs Officer Terry Williams said the agency made the decision Wednesday. The agency has the plane's flight data and voice recorders. Williams says they will also interview crew members and possibly passengers and gather information from the plane to try to determine what happened on Monday's flight and if there are any recommendations that could prevent a recurrence. Three crew members and two passengers were injured as people were thrown around the plane during the sudden drop. One flight attendant remained hospitalized after Monday night. United spokeswoman Kristen David said yesterday the company would no longer give updates on her out of respect for her privacy.
When John and Courtney McKee opened their new microdistillery Headframe Spirits in Butte in early 2012, they had no idea their success would lead to them being named Montana Entrepreneurs of the Year for 2013. Besides producing bourbon and gin and other spirits, their company also manufactures distillation equipment for Montana's growing distillery industry. In this feature interview, Courtney McKee talks with news director Sally Mock about how they decided to start their own company when John got laid off from his previous job.
We were not interested in leaving Butte, so we didn't want to follow biodiesel jobs around the country. We wanted very much to stay in our community, and John was very brokenhearted, having worked so hard for his previous employer and having not been responsible for the outcome. You can work very hard, but when you are not actually a driver at the company, when you are not a decision maker, you're in a really difficult spot. And when things go south, you wonder if you could have done more or could have done something better or different. And ultimately, you wind up feeling sort of powerless. And that was a position that neither one of us wanted to find him in again. And that was the impetus for starting a business of our own, being able to stay here, make jobs for ourselves, make jobs for other people, and be the masters of our own destiny from that perspective.
And why Spirits, of all the options you probably had?
Well, John's background, the company that he worked for before, distilled biodiesel. So they essentially made large refineries that produced biodiesel through a distillation process. So John had knowledge of large-scale distillation, which is rare in the micro-distilling industry, to walk into the industry with knowledge of the distillation process. Many people pick that up as they decide to get into the business. We felt like we had a leg up by already having that knowledge and experience.
Of course, a lot of people, Courtney, would love to be masters of their own fate and have their own business, and a lot of people think about that. But thinking about it and making it happen and facing all the challenges that presents, what do you think gets you over the hump of doing that and actually taking the leap?
Well, the decision-making, Sally, was really the easy part. It truly was the night that we had the idea that we were very sold on the concept. I had run an IT company for about 8 years before that, so I was comfortable with the idea that I could handle business management on a, you know, on a larger scale. That part wasn't intimidating to us. The part that was challenging was really sticking to our conviction, continuing to believe in ourselves, and in the plan that we'd put together through almost 12 months of bank rejections. So we were a very difficult project to get financed. You know, in 2010, when you walked into a bank and said, I want a large amount of money to start a new business in a relatively unknown industry that you as the banker are going to have a hard time finding historical data on, the answer was no over and over and over again. And for me personally, that was probably the most challenging part, continuing to believe in myself and believe in our vision in response to no after no after no.
Well, you can't really, of course, blame the bankers, but how did you get them to say yes?
We found a bank that recognized our project for what it was, recognized that what we were doing was value-added agricultural manufacturing. So somebody who was willing to look at us as an ag project and willing to work with us and get creative to build a package that was going to work for them and work for us. And we're really grateful to them for participating. Part of that process, too, included assistance from the SBA, Small Business Administration, correct. Our loan was in part an SBA 504, which means that the SBA guaranteed 35% of our project cost there. So we were required to put up 15%, and the bank then was only obligated to put up 50%. Which we couldn't have been successful in funding our project if it weren't for the assistance of the SBA.
And you, I understand, wanted to start small, but you actually have grown at a pace that you never expected, right?
That's very, very true. We anticipated that that it would be probably about 12 months or so of my husband and I working together, of me continuing to run my consulting company part-time, and it would be the two of us, and maybe after 12 months or so, we could look at giving my husband a paycheck. Instead, we began hiring people when we'd been open less than 3 months, and we put five people on staff that very first day. We are at 24 people right now, with the 25th coming on next month, and I'm really proud to be able to say that we've created one job for each month that we've been open.
Why do you think it's taken off so well? I mean, obviously you have a product that people like.
We do, but we've also built a really diverse business model. So we produce five spirits here that are our own Headframe brands, and we operate a tasting room in Butte here where folks can come in and sample what we do. And, of course, we distribute our product throughout the state, throughout the state of Illinois as well, and we're working on distribution in Canada. We have a small presence in Washington State as well. But we knew right off the bat that we wanted a degree of diversification. So part of what we do at Headframe is we manufacture distillation equipment. So we build stills for other micro distilleries. So we manufacture equipment for our industry. This is a great time to be a distillery, that there's a boom nationwide in folks interested in micro spirits the way they were in micro beers, you know, starting as early as 25 years ago and continuing right up through today. So we carry a really diverse business model, which accounts for a lot of our large staff.
And it's true that it's a booming industry in Montana and nationally. I think just a few years ago, there was no distillery in Montana, and now there are several.
That's correct. Goodness, I believe there are about 15 to 17 federally licensed entities in the state of Montana, which is a really big deal. When we got our license about 2.5 years ago, we were the 12th. So there are a number of new entities who have come online after us, and even more who are anywhere from concept to working on their paperwork and licensing right now.
And understand that history of Butte is something that is very important to both you and John, and that you have incorporated that history into your company. And in one way, you've done that with a very historic bar in your tasting room, right?
We are so fortunate to get to display the Rocky Mountain Bar in our tasting room. That is a project that we worked with the World Museum of Mining here in Butte on. The museum had the bar and did not have a good place to display it. We had a great place to display it, and so we have the bar on long-term loan from the Mining Museum.
And for those who are not Butteans, tell us more about the bar and why it's so historic.
The bar came from the Rocky Mountain Cafe. The Rocky Mountain Cafe was in the Italian neighborhood of Meaderville. Folks back in the mining days tended to live with other folks from their same home countries, so folks that spoke their same language. And Meaderville was where the Italians lived. As the pit expanded in Butte, as the Berkeley pit, the surface mining expanded, it took over, absorbed lots of different ethnic neighborhoods in Butte, and Meaderville was one of those. So truly houses were lost, families were displaced to allow mining operations to continue to grow. And when Meaderville was absorbed, the World Museum of Mining was a relatively new entity at the time, and the bar, rather than being just lost to history, was donated to the museum. So the museum has had possession of this bar since the early 1960s.
And you name your spirits after some of the old mines in Butte. There's the Orphan Girl Bourbon Cream Liqueur and the Never Sweat Bourbon Whiskey. I love those names.
Thank you. We really see our company, the purpose for our company, to add value to our community. So we see that from a current and future perspective, but we also see that really as a, you know, from a historic perspective as well. There are lots of folks in Montana and in larger areas as well that, you know, if they know anything about Butte, they know it as a mining town. They know it as a Superfund site, and we believe very strongly that Butte has a much bigger and more interesting story to tell than just that. So for us to use our bottles and our products to share Butte's story is really wonderful. We also work very hard to reinvest in our community to make sure that, that the company that we operate continues to add value to our community. For example, we donate a portion of the proceeds, each bottle of our Orphan Girl Bourbon Cream Liqueur, to the World Museum of Mining.
I also read that you and your husband want to make sure that you pay attention to the good fortune you've had with your company and that you tell each other every day, quote, don't get cocky.
That's one of my husband's favorite things to say. This has been a bigger and more exciting project for us than we had ever anticipated. We never expected the level of public recognition that we've received. We never expected the response from the community that we've received. It's really a wild place to be for us. We planned for a year and a half before we even received financing for our project. We built a business model. We built a plan. We kicked the tires on our plan. We further researched. We toured other distilleries. We made case studies of every business that we'd worked for, that that our friends and family had worked for, other businesses in Butte and around Montana. We really did our homework and thought that we'd built ourselves a really well-thought-out business plan, and never once did we anticipate the level of success that we've achieved. And then John and I have personally received recognition, being selected as the 2013 Montana Entrepreneurs of the Year is a really big deal. So it's important to us that that we be really mindful that the success that we've had comes from the support that we've received from the community, from Butte Silver Bow government, from state government as well, and that we be mindful all the time that this project belongs to many more people than just my husband and myself.
Well, you have a great story to tell, Courtney, and I have been speaking with Courtney McKee, who with her husband John have been selected Montana's Entrepreneurs of the Year for 2013 by Governor Steve Bullock and the Montana Ambassadors, and will receive that award in March at the Big Sky Resort. Well-deserved, and Courtney, congratulations, and thank you so much for the interview.
Thank you very much, Sally.
Now for this weekend's forecast. As we reported earlier, most of our listening area should expect some significant amounts of snow starting Sunday morning. West of the Divide, there's a winter storm watch in effect for snow from tomorrow afternoon through Monday morning for the Flathead and Mission Valleys, the Lower Clark Fork region, the Missoula and Bitterroot Valleys, the Bitterroot and Sapphire Mountains, the Butte Blackfoot region, and the Potomac Sealy Lake region. Tonight should be mostly cloudy with areas of snow. Lows should be 5 to 12 degrees. Tomorrow calls for mostly cloudy skies with a chance of snow and highs in the mid-20s to lower 30s. On Sunday, snow is likely with areas of blowing snow and highs should be in the 20s. In central Montana, there's a winter weather advisory in effect overnight for the Rocky Mountain Front and Cascade, Eastern Teton, Duluth Basin, Fergus, Marr, and central and southern Lewis and Clark counties. There's also a winter storm watch in effect from Sunday morning through Monday afternoon for the southern Rocky Mountain Front, Cascade, central and southern Lewis and Clark, Duluth Basin, Fergus, and Marr counties. Tonight, look for mostly cloudy skies with a chance of snow. Expect lows 0 to 10 degrees above. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a chance of snow through the day with highs 15 to 20 degrees. On Sunday, expect snow with highs 5 to 10 degrees. And in southwest Montana, there's a winter weather advisory in effect overnight for Gallatin, Jefferson, and Broadwater counties. There's also a winter storm watch in effect from Sunday morning through Monday afternoon for Jefferson, Broadwater, and Gallatin counties. Tonight should be mostly cloudy with a chance of snow and lows 5 to 10 degrees. Tomorrow calls for mostly cloudy skies with a chance of snow and highs in the 20s. On Sunday, look for mostly cloudy skies with snow and highs in the 20s. And now for the editorial comments of Caroline Bird.
For those of us who remember the grim forecasts for Yellowstone grizzly bears in the 1980s, the latest news from bear experts has been cause for celebration. From a low of fewer than 200 grizzlies a mere generation ago, more than three times that many roam Greater Yellowstone today. Eyeball tests have provided similar anecdotal data in recent years. Seeing a grizzly in Greater Yellowstone, while always a breathtaking thrill, is no longer the wildlife equivalent of a solar eclipse. More bears are in more places than they've been in our lifetimes. The Greater Yellowstone Coalition was formed 30 years ago to help rescue the Yellowstone grizzly from extinction. We rejoice with our partners, federal and state wildlife managers, fellow conservation groups, visionary landowners, and many, many others, over one of the great conservation success stories of our time. But now the question is, what's next for the great bear? We can't simply pat ourselves on the back in congratulatory satisfaction and move on to the next challenge. In many ways, our work on the Yellowstone grizzly bear has just begun. For three decades, GYC and other bear champions have been playing defense. Our mission has been to save a keystone species and ensure that Greater Yellowstone remains a healthy cornerstone of one of the planet's 12 remaining intact ecosystems. Well, today we ask ourselves one fundamental question. What's best for Yellowstone grizzlies in the long run? We, of course, will remain vigilant over how the grizzly is managed, whether it's by the federal government or the states of Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming. But we believe the bear and the growing number of people who live, work, and recreate in Greater Yellowstone will be best served by sharply focused on-the-ground efforts that foster coexistence with humans while also protecting habitat and ensuring linkage with other bear populations in the Northern Rockies. Specifically, our work will revolve around what we call the three C's. That's core habitat, connectivity, and conflict reduction. Let's start with conflict reduction. The vast majority of grizzly bear mortality is the result of unfortunate encounters with people. Working with our partners, GYC's goal is to reduce human-caused mortality and build durable social acceptance for living safely with bears. Tangible ways to accomplish this include outfitting Greater Yellowstone's communities, campgrounds, and trailheads with bear-proof containers, ensuring that every hunter and hiker in grizzly country carries bear spray, and working with residents and visitors alike about proper storage of bear attractants, such as pet food, bird food, and garbage. And other effective tools that are at our fingertips. Electric fencing keeps ranchers' livestock safe from grizzlies and other predators. Carcass removal on ranches eliminates irresistible magnets for bears. Does it work? Yes. Since 2007, GYC has partnered with the U.S. Forest Service and Idaho Fish and Game to distribute more than 200 bear-proof garbage bins in Island Park, Idaho. The result, Island Park had only one conflict over garbage in 2013. Another shining example of such work is underway in Montana's Blackfoot Valley, where landowners, wildlife managers, business leaders, and conservationists have used such programs to reduce grizzly bear conflicts by 96%. 96% in the last 15 years. Our second C is connection. Connecting Greater Yellowstone bears with animals from the crown of the continent, the Glacier National Park region, and Bob Marshall Wilderness Complex is another key to sustaining the grizzly population. Well, perhaps the greatest threat to the Greater Yellowstone's grizzlies in a time of climate change is that they're an island population, separated from those bears to the north. Today, with both populations expanding, bears are a mere 60 to 80 miles apart. Connecting these distinct populations will be a game changer for Yellowstone grizzly. To that end, GYC and our partners are engaged with landowners and wildlife managers to protect and reconnect habitats, especially along streams. In the Upper Madison River Valley, for example, we're working to restore streamside vegetation in places grizzlies use to move across the landscape to the benefit of all wildlife, not just bears. And finally, without question, safe and secure core habitat for grizzly bears within Greater Yellowstone is critical to their long-term success. Protecting wild country isn't just good for bears, it's good for people, too. The same country that's so critical for a healthy grizzly bear population also produces clean water, unparalleled hunting and fishing opportunities, world-class wildlife watching, and drives our tourism and business economy. If we have a healthy bear population, we have healthy natural systems. We will continue to work with federal and state agencies, communities, landowners, and others to ensure this region remains intact and functional for bears and for people. Yellowstone grizzlies have made a remarkable comeback, and for that we celebrate. Now it's time to roll up our sleeves, focus on core habitat, connectivity, and conflict reduction, and do the work necessary to sustain Greater Yellowstone's iconic symbol of wildness, the grizzly bear. I'm Caroline Bird, Executive Director for the Greater Yellowstone Coalition, a Bozeman-based nonprofit dedicated to protecting the lands, waters, and wildlife of the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem.
Carolyn Bird is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening. Stay safe on those roads this weekend and have a great weekend.